tension with special relativity would be resolved. But achieving this goal is not a trivial task. To see this concretely, let's think about how good old-fashioned textbook quantum mechanics explains the aspect experiment. According to standard quantum mechanics, when we perform a measurement and find a particle to be here, we cause its probability wave to change. The previous range of potential outcomes is reduced to the one actual result our measurement finds. Physicists say the measurement causes the probability wave to collapse, and they envision that the larger the initial probability wave at some location, the larger the likelihood that the wave will collapse to that point. That is, the larger the likelihood that the particle will be found at that point. In the standard approach, the collapse happens instantaneously across the whole universe. Once you find the particle here, the thinking goes, the probability of its being found anywhere else immediately drops to zero. And this is reflected in an immediate collapse of the probability wave. In the aspect experiment, when the left moving photon's spin is measured and is found, say, to be clockwise about some axis, this collapses its probability wave throughout all of space, instantaneously setting the counterclockwise part to zero. Since this collapse happens everywhere, it happens also at the location of the right moving photon. And it turns out, this affects the counterclockwise part of the right-moving photon's probability wave, causing it to collapse to zero, too. Thus, no matter how far away the right-moving photon is from the left-moving photon, its probability wave is instantaneously affected by the change in the left-moving photon's probability wave, ensuring that it has the same spin as the left-moving photon along the chosen axis. In standard quantum mechanics, then, it is this instantaneous change in probability waves that is responsible for the faster-than-light influence. The mathematics of quantum mechanics makes this qualitative discussion precise. And indeed, the long-range influences arising from collapsing probability waves change the prediction of how often aspects left and right detectors, when their axes are randomly and independently chosen, should find the same result. A mathematical calculation is required to get the exact answer, but when the math is done, it predicts that the detectors should agree precisely 50% of the time, rather than predicting agreement more than 50% of the time. The result, as we've seen, found using EPR's hypothesis of a local universe. To impressive accuracy, this is just what Aspect found in his experiments. 50% agreement. Standard quantum mechanics matches the data. This is a spectacular success. Nevertheless, there is a hitch. After more than 7 decades, no one understands how or even whether the collapse of a probability wave really happens. Over the years, the assumption that probability waves collapse has proven itself a powerful link between the probabilities that quantum theory predicts and the definite outcomes that experiments reveal. But it's an assumption fraught with conundrums. For one thing, the collapse does not emerge from the mathematics of quantum theory. It has to be put in by hand, and there is no agreed-upon or experimentally justified way to do this. For another, how is it possible that by finding an electron in your detector in New York City, you cause the electron's probability wave in the Andromeda Galaxy to drop to zero instantaneously? To be sure, once you find the particle in New York City, it definitely won't be found in Andromeda. But what unknown mechanism enforces this with such spectacular efficiency? How, in looser language, does the part of the probability wave in Andromeda, and everywhere else, know to drop to zero simultaneously? We will take up this quantum mechanical measurement problem in Chapter 7. And as we'll see, there are other proposals that avoid the idea of collapsing probability waves entirely. But suffice it here to note that, as we discussed in Chapter 3, something that is simultaneous from one perspective is not simultaneous from another moving perspective. Remember Itchy and Scratchy setting their clocks on a moving train. So, if a probability wave were to undergo simultaneous collapse across space, according to one observer, it will not undergo such simultaneous collapse, according to another who is in motion. As a matter of fact, depending on their motion, some observers will report that the left photon was measured first, while other observers, equally trustworthy, will report that the right photon was measured first. Hence, even if the idea of collapsing probability waves were correct, there would fail to be an objective truth regarding which measurement, on the left or right photon, affected which. Thus, the collapse of probability waves would seem to pick out one vantage point as special, the one according to which the collapse is simultaneous across space, the one according to which the left and right measurements occur with the same moment. But picking out a special perspective creates significant tension with the egalitarian core of special relativity. Proposals have been made to circumvent this problem, but debate continues regarding which, if any, are successful. Thus, although the majority view holds that there is a harmonious coexistence, some physicists and philosophers consider the exact relationship between quantum mechanics, entangled particles, and special relativity an open question. It's certainly possible, and in my view likely, that the majority view will ultimately prevail in some more definitive form. But history shows that subtle foundational problems sometimes sow the seeds of future revolutions. On this one, only time will tell. What are we to make of all this? Bell's reasoning and Aspect's experiments show that the kind of universe Einstein envisioned may exist in the mind, but not in reality. Einstein's was a universe in which what you do right here has immediate relevance only for things that are also right here. Physics, in his view, was purely local. But we now see that the data rule out this kind of thinking. The data rule out this kind of universe. Einstein's was also a universe in which objects possess definite values of all possible physical attributes. Attributes do not hang in limbo, waiting for an experimenter's measurement to bring them into existence. The majority of physicists would say that Einstein was wrong on this point, too. Particle properties, in this majority view, come into being when measurements force them to, an idea we will examine further in Chapter 7. When they are not being observed or interacting with the environment, particle properties have a nebulous, fuzzy existence characterized solely by a probability that one or another potentiality might be realized. The most extreme of those who hold this opinion would go as far as declaring that, indeed, when no one and no thing is looking at or interacting with the moon in any way, it is not there. On this issue, the jury is still out. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen had reasoned that the only sensible explanation for how measurements could reveal that widely separated particles had identical properties was that the particles possessed those definite properties all along. And, by virtue of their common past, their properties were correlated. Decades later, Bell's reasoning and Aspect's data proved that this intuitively pleasing suggestion, based on the premise that particles always have definite properties, fails as an explanation of the experimentally observed non-local correlations. But the failure to explain away the mysteries of non-locality does not mean that the notion of particles always possessing definite properties is itself ruled out. The data rule out a local universe, but they don't rule out particles having such hidden properties. In fact, in the 1950s, Bohm constructed his own version of quantum mechanics that incorporates both non-locality and hidden variables. Particles, in this approach, always have both a definite position and a definite velocity, even though we can never measure both simultaneously. Bohm's approach made predictions that agreed fully with those of conventional quantum mechanics, but his formulation introduced an even more brazen element of non-locality, in which the forces acting on a particle at one location depend instantaneously on conditions at distant locations. In a sense, then, Bohm's version suggested how one might go part way toward Einstein's goal of restoring some of the intuitively sensible features of classical physics, particles having definite properties, that had been abandoned by the quantum revolution. But it also showed that doing so came at the price of accepting yet more blatant non-locality. With this hefty cost, Einstein would have found little solace in this approach. The need to abandon locality is the most astonishing lesson arising from the work of Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen, Bohm, Bell, and Aspect, as well as the many others who played important parts in this line of research. By virtue of their past, objects that at present are in vastly different regions of the universe can be part of the quantum mechanically entangled whole. Even though widely separated, such objects are committed to behaving in a random but coordinated manner. We used to think that a basic property of space is that it separates and distinguishes one object from another. But we now see that quantum mechanics radically challenges this view. Two things can be separated by an enormous amount of space and yet not have a fully independent existence. A quantum connection can unite them, making the properties of each contingent on the properties of the other. Space does not distinguish such entangled objects. Space cannot overcome their interconnection. Space, even a huge amount of space, does not weaken their quantum mechanical interdependence. Some people have interpreted this as telling us that everything is connected to everything else, or that quantum mechanics entangles us all in one universal whole. After all, the reasoning goes, at the Big Bang, everything emerged from one place, since we believe all places we now think of as different were the same place way back in the beginning. And since, like the two photons emerging from the same calcium atom, everything emerged from the same something in the beginning, everything should be quantum mechanically entangled with everything else. While I like the sentiment, such gushy talk is loose and overstated. The quantum connections between the two photons emerging from the calcium atom are there, certainly, but they are extremely delicate. When Aspect and others carry out their experiments, it is crucial that the photons be allowed to travel absolutely unimpeded from their source to the detectors. Should they be jostled by stray particles, or bump into pieces of equipment before reaching one of the detectors, the quantum connection between the photons will become monumentally more difficult to identify. Rather than looking for correlations in the properties of two photons, one would now need to look for a complex pattern of correlations involving the photons and everything else they may have bumped into. And as all these particles go their ways, bumping and jostling yet other particles, the quantum entanglement would become so spread out through these interactions with the environment that it would become virtually impossible to detect. For all intents and purposes, the original entanglement between the photons would have been erased. Nevertheless, it is truly amazing that these connections do exist, and that in carefully arranged laboratory conditions, they can be directly observed over significant distances. They show us, fundamentally, that space is not what we once thought it was. What about time?
Part 2. Time and Experience. Chapter 5. The Frozen River. Does Time Flow? Time is among the most familiar, yet least understood concepts that humanity has ever encountered. We say that it flies. We say that it's money. We try to save it. We get annoyed when we waste it. But what is time? To paraphrase St. Augustine and Justice Potter Stewart, we know it when we see it. But surely, at the dawn of the third millennium, our understanding of time must be deeper than that. In some ways it is. In other ways it's not. Through centuries of puzzling and pondering, we have gained insight into some of time's mysteries, but many remain. Where does time come from? What would it mean to have a universe without time? Could there be more than one time dimension, just as there is more than one space dimension? Can we travel to the past? If we did, could we change the subsequent unfolding of events? Is there an absolute smallest amount of time? Is time a truly fundamental ingredient in the makeup of the cosmos, or simply a useful construct to organize our perceptions, but one not found in the lexicon with which the most fundamental laws of the universe are written? Could time be a derivative notion, emerging from some more basic concept that has yet to be discovered? Finding complete and fully convincing answers to these questions ranks among the most ambitious goals of modern science. Yet the big questions are by no means the only ones. Even the everyday experience of time taps into some of the universe's thorniest conundrums. Time and experience. Special and general relativity shattered the universality, the oneness, of time. These theories showed that we each pick up a shard of Newton's old universal time and carry it with us. It becomes our own personal clock, our own personal lead relentlessly pulling us from one moment to the next. We are shocked by the theories of relativity, by the universe that is, because while our personal clock seems to tick away uniformly, in concert with our intuitive sense of time, comparison with other clocks reveals differences. Time for you need not be the same as time for me. Let's accept that lesson as a given. But what is the true nature of time for me? What is the full character of time as experienced and conceived by the individual, without primary focus on comparisons with the experiences of others? Do these experiences accurately reflect the true nature of time? And what do they tell us about the nature of reality? Our experiences teach us, overwhelmingly so, that the past is different from the future. The future seems to present a wealth of possibilities, while the past is bound to one thing, the fact of what actually happened. We feel able to influence, to affect, and to mold the future to one degree or another, while the past seems immutable. And in between past and future is the slippery concept of now, a temporal holding point that reinvents itself moment to moment, like the frames in a movie film as they sweep past the projector's intense light beam and become the momentary present. Time seems to march to an endless, perfectly uniform rhythm, reaching the fleeting destination of now with every beat of the drummer's stick. Our experiences also teach us that there is an apparent lopsidedness to how things unfold in time. There is no use crying over spilled milk, because once spilled, it can never be unspilled. We never see splattered milk gather itself together, rise off the floor, and coalesce in a glass that sets itself upright on a kitchen counter. Our world seems to adhere perfectly to a one-way temporal arrow, never deviating from the fixed stipulation that things can start like this and end like that, but they can never start like that and end like this. Our experiences, therefore, teach us two overarching things about time. First, time seems to flow. It's as if we stand on the riverbank of time as the mighty current rushes by, sweeping the future toward us, becoming now at the moment it reaches us, and rushing onward as it recedes downstream into the past. Or, if that is too passive for your taste, invert the metaphor.
We ride the river of time as it relentlessly rushes forward, sweeping us from one now to the next. As the past recedes with the passing scenery, and the future forever awaits us downstream. Our experiences have also taught us that time can inspire some of the mushiest metaphors. Second, time seems to have an arrow. The flow of time seems to go one way and only one way, in the sense that things happen in one and only one temporal sequence. If someone hands you a box containing a short film of a glass of milk being spilled, but the film has been cut up into its individual frames, by examining the pile of images, you can reassemble the frames in the right order without any help or instruction from the filmmaker. Time seems to have an intrinsic direction, pointing from what we call the past toward what we call the future. And things appear to change. Milk spills, eggs break, candles burn, people age, in universal alignment with this direction. These easily sensed features of time generate some of its most tantalizing puzzles. Does time really flow? If it does, what actually is flowing? And how fast does this time stuff flow? Does time really have an arrow? Space, for example, does not appear to have an inherent arrow. To an astronaut in the dark recesses of the cosmos, left and right, back and forth, and up and down, would all be on equal footing. So where would an arrow of time come from? If there is an arrow of time, is it absolute? Or are there things that can evolve in a direction opposite to the way time's arrow seems to point? Let's build up to our current understanding by first thinking about these questions in the context of classical physics. So, for the remainder of this and the next chapter, in which we'll discuss the flow of time and the arrow of time, respectively, we will ignore quantum probability and quantum uncertainty. A good deal of what we'll learn, nevertheless, translates directly to the quantum domain. And in Chapter 7, we will take up the quantum perspective. Does time flow? From the perspective of sentient beings, the answer seems obvious. As I type these words, I clearly feel time flowing. With every keystroke, each now gives way to the next. As you read these words, you no doubt feel time flowing too. Yet, as hard as physicists have tried, no one has found any convincing evidence within the laws of physics that supports this intuitive sense that time flows. In fact, a reframing of some of Einstein's insights from special relativity provides evidence that time does not flow. To understand this, let's return to the loaf of bread depiction of space-time introduced in Chapter 3. Recall that the slices making up the loaf are the nows of a given observer. Each slice represents space at one moment of time from his or her perspective. The union obtained by placing slice next to slice, in the order in which the observer experiences them, fills out a region of space-time. If we take this perspective to a logical extreme, and imagine that each slice depicts all of space at a given moment of time, according to one observer's viewpoint, and if we include every possible slice, from the ancient past to the distant future, the loaf will encompass all of the universe throughout all time, the whole of space-time. Every occurrence, regardless of when or where, is represented by some point in the loaf. But the perspective should make you scratch your head. The outside perspective in which we're looking at the whole universe, all of space at every moment of time, is a fictitious vantage point, one that none of us will ever have. We are all within space-time. Every experience you or I ever have occurs at some location in space at some moment of time. And since our imaginary perspective is meant to depict all of space-time, it encompasses the totality of such experiences, yours, mine, and those of everyone and everything. If you could zoom in and closely examine all the comings and goings on planet Earth, you'd be able to see Alexander the Great having a lesson with Aristotle, Leonardo da Vinci laying the final brushstroke on the Mona Lisa, and George Washington crossing the Delaware. As you continued scanning the image from left to right, you'd be able to see your grandmother playing as a little girl, your father celebrating his 10th birthday, and your own first day at school. Looking yet farther to the right in the image, you could see yourself reading this book, the birth of your great-great-granddaughter, and a little farther on, her inauguration as president. From your imaginary perspective, you can't actually see these moments, but you can see the history of the Sun and planet Earth, from their birth out of a coalescing gas cloud to the Earth's demise when the Sun swells into a red giant. It's all there. Unquestionably, this is an imaginary perspective. It stands outside of space and time. It is the view from nowhere and no when. Even so, even though we can't actually step beyond the confines of space-time and take in the full sweep of the universe, this perspective provides a powerful means of analyzing and clarifying basic properties of space and time. As a prime example, the intuitive sense of time's flow can be vividly portrayed in this framework by a variation on the movie projector metaphor. We can envision a light that illuminates one time slice after another, momentarily making the slice come alive in the present, making it the momentary now, only to let it go instantly dark again as the light moves on to the next slice. Right now, in this intuitive way of thinking about time, the light is illuminating the slice in which you, sitting on planet Earth, are reading this word. And now it is illuminating the slice in which you are reading this word. But again, while this image seems to match experience, scientists have been unable to find anything in the laws of physics that embodies such a moving light. They have found no physical mechanism that singles out moment after moment to be momentarily real, to be the momentary now, as the mechanism flows ever onward toward the future. Quite the contrary. While our perspective is certainly imaginary, there is convincing evidence that the space-time loaf, the totality of space-time, not slice by single slice, is real. A less than widely appreciated implication of Einstein's work is that special relativistic reality treats all times equally. Although the notion of now plays a central role in our worldview, relativity subverts our intuition once again and declares ours an egalitarian universe in which every moment is as real as any other. We brushed up against this idea in Chapter 3 while thinking about the spinning bucket in the context of special relativity. There, through indirect reasoning analogous to Newton's, we concluded that space-time is at least enough of a something to provide the benchmark for accelerated motion. Here we take up the issue from another viewpoint and go further. We argue that every part of the space-time loaf exists on the same footing as every other, suggesting, as Einstein believed, that reality embraces past, present, and future equally, and that the flow we envision bringing one section to light as another goes dark is illusory. The persistent illusion of past, present, and future. To understand Einstein's perspective, we need a working definition of reality, an algorithm, if you will, for determining what things exist at a given moment. Here's one common approach. When I contemplate reality, what exists at this moment, I picture in my mind's eye a kind of snapshot, a mental freeze-frame image of the entire universe right now. As I type these words, my sense of what exists right now, my sense of reality, amounts to a list of all those things. The tick of midnight on my kitchen clock. My cat stretched out in flight between floor and windowsill. The first ray of morning sunshine illuminating Dublin. The hubbub on the floor of the Tokyo Stock Exchange. The fusion of two particular hydrogen atoms in the sun. The emission of a photon from the Orion Nebula. The last moment of a dying star before it collapses into a black hole. That are, at this moment, in my freeze-frame mental image. These are the things happening right now. So they are the things that I declare exist right now. Does Charlemagne exist right now? No. Does Nero exist right now? No. Does Lincoln exist right now? No. Does Elvis exist right now? No. None of them are on my current now list. Does anyone born in the year 2300 or 3500 or 57,000 exist now? No. Again, none of them are in my mind's eye freeze-frame image. None of them are on my current time slice. And so, none of them are on my current now list. Therefore, I say without hesitation that they do not currently exist. That is how I define reality at any given moment. It's an intuitive approach that most of us use, often implicitly, when thinking about existence. I will make use of this conception below, but be aware of one tricky point. A now list, reality in this way of thinking, is a funny thing. Nothing you see right now belongs on your now list, because it takes time for light to reach your eyes. Anything you see right now has already happened. You are not seeing the words on this page as they are now. Instead, if you are holding the book a foot from your face, you are seeing them as they were a billionth of a second ago. If you look out across an average room, you are seeing things as they were some 10 billionths to 20 billionths of a second ago. If you look across the Grand Canyon, you are seeing the other side as it was about 1/10,000th of a second ago. If you look at the moon, you are seeing it as it was a second and a half ago. For the sun, you see it as it was about 8 minutes ago. For stars visible to the naked eye, you see them as they were from roughly a few years ago to 10,000 years ago. Curiously, then, although a mental freeze-frame image captures our sense of reality, our intuitive sense of what's out there, it consists of events that we can't experience or affect or even record right now. Instead, an actual now list can be compiled only after the fact. If you know how far away something is, you can determine when it emitted the light you see now, and so you can determine on which of your time slices it belongs, on which already past now list it should be recorded. Nevertheless, and this is the main point, as we use this information to compile the now list for any given moment, continually updating it as we receive light from ever more distant sources, the things that are listed are the things that we intuitively believe existed at that moment. Remarkably, this seemingly straightforward way of thinking leads to an unexpectedly expansive conception of reality. You see, according to Newton's absolute space and absolute time, everyone's freeze-frame picture of the universe at a given moment contains exactly the same events. Everyone's now is the same now, and so everyone's now list for a given moment is identical. If someone or something is on your now list for a given moment, then it is necessarily also on my now list for that moment. Most people's intuition is still bound up with this way of thinking. But special relativity tells a very different story. Let's return to our imaginary outside perspective of time. Two observers in relative motion have nows, single moments in time from each one's perspective, that are different. Their nows slice through space-time at different angles. And different nows mean different now lists. Observers moving relative to each other have different conceptions of what exists at a given moment, and hence they have different conceptions of reality. At everyday speeds, the angle between two observers' now slices is minuscule. That's why, in day-to-day life, we never notice a discrepancy between our definition of now and anybody else's. For this reason, most discussions of special relativity focus on what would happen if we traveled at enormous speeds, speeds near that of light, since such motion would tremendously magnify the effects. But there is another way to magnify the distinction between two observers' conceptions of now, and I find that it provides a particularly enlightening approach to the question of reality. It is based on the following simple fact. If you and I slice up an ordinary loaf at slightly different angles, it will have hardly any effect on the resulting pieces of bread. But if the loaf is huge, the conclusion is different. Just as a tiny opening between the blades of an enormously long pair of scissors translates into a large separation between the blade tips, cutting an enormous loaf of bread at slightly different angles yields slices that deviate by a huge amount at distances far from where the slices cross. The same is true for space-time. At everyday speeds, the slices depicting now for two observers in relative motion will be oriented at only slightly different angles. If the two observers are nearby, this will have hardly any effect. But, just as in the loaf of bread, tiny angles generate large separations between slices when their impact is examined over large distances. And for slices of space-time, a large deviation between slices means a significant disagreement on which events each observer considers to be happening now. This implies that individuals moving relative to each other, even at ordinary everyday speeds, will have increasingly different conceptions of now if they are increasingly far apart in space. To make this concrete, imagine that Chewie is on a planet in a galaxy far, far away, 10 billion light-years from Earth, idly sitting in his living room. Imagine further that you, sitting still reading these words, and Chewie, are not moving relative to each other. For simplicity, ignore the motion of the planets, the expansion of the universe, gravitational effects, and so on. Since you are at rest relative to each other, you and Chewie agree fully on issues of space and time. You would slice up space-time in an identical manner, and so your now lists would coincide exactly. After a little while, Chewie stands up and goes for a walk, a gentle, relaxing amble, in a direction that turns out to be directly away from you. This change in Chewie's state of motion means that his conception of now, his slicing up of space-time, will rotate slightly. This tiny angular change has no noticeable effect in Chewie's vicinity. The difference between his new now and that of anyone still sitting in his living room is minuscule. But over the enormous distance of 10 billion light-years, this tiny shift in Chewie's notion of now is amplified, with Chewie's now and your now being a huge distance apart, significantly accentuating the shift in your nows. His now and your now, which were one and the same while he was sitting still, jump apart because of his modest motion. By using the equations of special relativity, we can calculate how different your nows become. If Chewie walks away from you at about 10 miles per hour, Chewie has quite a stride, the events on Earth that belong on his new now list are events that happened about 150 years ago, according to you. according to his conception of now, a conception that is every bit as valid as yours, and that up until a moment ago agreed fully with yours, you have not yet been born. If he moved toward you at the same speed, the angular shift would be opposite, so that his now would coincide with what you would call 150 years in the future. Now, according to his now, you may no longer be a part of this world. And if, instead of just walking, Chewie hopped into the Millennium Falcon, traveling at 1,000 miles per hour, less than the speed of a Concorde aircraft, his now would include events on Earth that, from your perspective, took place 15,000 years ago, or 15,000 years in the future, depending on whether he flew away or toward you. Given suitable choices of direction and speed of motion, Elvis, or Nero, or Charlemagne, or Lincoln, or someone born on Earth way into what you call the future, will belong on his new now list. While surprising, none of this generates any contradiction or paradox, because, as we explained above, the farther away something is, the longer it takes to receive light it emits, and hence to determine that it belongs on a particular now list. For instance, even though John Wilkes Booth's approaching the state box at Ford's Theater will belong on Chewie's new now list if he gets up and walks away from Earth at about 9.3 miles per hour, he can take no action to save President Lincoln. At such an enormous distance, it takes an enormous amount of time for messages to be received and exchanged. So only Chewie's descendants, billions of years later, will actually receive the light from that fateful night in Washington. The point, though, is that when his descendants use this information to update the vast collection of past now lists, they will find that the Lincoln assassination belongs on the same now list that contains Chewie's just getting up and walking away from Earth. And yet they will also find that a moment before Chewie got up, his now list contained, among many other things, you, in Earth's 21st century, sitting still, reading these words. Similarly, there are things about our future, such as who will win the U.S. presidential election in the year 2100, that seem completely open. More than likely, the candidates for that election haven't even been born, much less decided to run for office. But if Chewie gets up from his chair and walks toward Earth at about 6.4 miles per hour, his now slice, his conception of what exists, his conception of what has happened, will include the selection of the first president of the 22nd century. Something that seems completely undecided to us is something that, for him, has already happened. Again, Chewie won't know the outcome of the election for billions of years, since that's how long it will take our television signals to reach him. But when word of the election results reaches Chewie's descendants, and they use it to update their history books, their collections of past now lists, they will find that the election results belong on the same now list in which Chewie got up and started walking toward Earth. A now list, Chewie's descendants note, that occurs just a moment after one that contains you, in Earth's 21st century, finishing this paragraph. This example highlights two important points. First, although we are used to the idea that relativistic effects become apparent at speeds near that of light, even at low velocities, relativistic effects can be greatly amplified when considered over large distances in space. Second, the example gives insight into the issue of whether space-time, the loaf, is really an entity or just an abstract concept, an abstract union of space right now, together with its history and purported future. You see, Chewie's conception of reality, his freeze-frame mental image, his conception of what exists now, is every bit as real for him as our conception of reality is for us. So, in assessing what constitutes reality, it would be stunningly narrow-minded if we didn't also include his perspective. For Newton, such an egalitarian approach wouldn't make the slightest difference, because in a universe with absolute space and absolute time, everyone's now slice coincides. But in a relativistic universe, our universe, it makes a big difference. Whereas our familiar conception of what exists right now amounts to a single now slice, we usually view the past as gone and the future as yet to be. We must augment this image with Chewie's now slice, a now slice that, as the discussion revealed, can differ substantially from our own. Furthermore, since Chewie's initial location and the speed with which he moves are arbitrary, we should include the now slices associated with all possibilities. These now slices, as in our discussion above, would be centered on Chewie's, or some other real or hypothetical observer's, initial location in space, and would be rotated at an angle that depends on the velocity chosen. The only restriction comes from the speed limit set by light, and in the graphic depiction we are using, this translates into a limit on the rotation angle of 45 degrees, either clockwise or counterclockwise. The collection of all these now slices fills out a substantial region of the space-time loaf. In fact, if space is infinite, if now slices extend infinitely far, then the rotated now slices can be centered arbitrarily far away, and hence their union sweeps through every point in the space-time loaf. Pick any point in the loaf. Draw a slice that includes the point, and which intersects our current now slice at an angle that is less than 45 degrees. This slice will represent the now slice, reality, of a distant observer who was initially at rest relative to us, like Chewie, but is now moving relative to us at less than the speed of light. By design, this slice includes the arbitrary point in the loaf you happened to pick. So, if you buy the notion that reality consists of the things in your freeze-frame mental image right now, and if you agree that your now is no more valid than the now of someone located far away in space who can move freely, then reality encompasses all of the events in space-time. The total loaf exists. Just as we envision all of space as really being out there, as really existing, we should also envision all of time as really being out there, as really existing too. Past, present, and future certainly appear to be distinct entities. But as Einstein once said, "For we convinced physicists, the distinction between past, present, and future is only an illusion, however persistent. The only thing that's real is the whole of space-time." Experience and the flow of time. In this way of thinking, events, regardless of when they happen from any particular perspective, just are. They all exist. They eternally occupy their particular point in space-time. There is no flow. If you were having a great time at the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve 1999, you still are, since that is just one immutable location in space-time. It is tough to accept this description, since our worldview so forcefully distinguishes between past, present, and future. But if we stare intently at this familiar temporal scheme, and confront it with the cold, hard facts of modern physics, its only place of refuge seems to lie within the human mind. Undeniably, our conscious experience seems to sweep through the slices. It is as though our minds provide the projector light referred to earlier, so that moments of time come to life when they are illuminated by the power of consciousness. The flowing sensation from one moment to the next arises from our conscious recognition of change in our thoughts, feelings, and perceptions. And the sequence of change seems to have a continuous motion. It seems to unfold into a coherent story. But, without any pretense of psychological or neurobiological precision, We can envision how we might experience a flow of time, even though, in actuality, there may be no such thing. To see what I mean, imagine playing Gone with the Wind through a faulty DVD player that randomly jumps forward and backward. One still frame flashes momentarily on the screen, and is followed immediately by another from a completely different part of the film. When you watch this jumbled version, it will be hard for you to make sense of what's going on. But Scarlett and Rhett have no problem. In each frame, they do what they've always done in that frame. Were you able to stop the DVD on some particular frame and ask them about their thoughts and memories, they'd respond with the same answers they would have given had you played the DVD in a properly functioning player. If you ask them whether it was confusing to romp through the Civil War out of order, they'd look at you quizzically and figure you'd tossed back one too many mint juleps. In any given time frame, they'd have the thoughts and memories they've always had in that frame. And in particular, those thoughts and memories would give them the sensation that time is smoothly and coherently flowing forward, as usual. Similarly, each moment in space-time, each time slice, is like one of the still frames in a film. It exists whether or not some light illuminates it. As for Scarlett and Rhett, to the you who is in any such moment, it is the now. It is the moment you experience at that moment. And it always will be. Moreover, within each individual slice, your thoughts and memories are sufficiently rich to yield a sense that time has continuously flowed to that moment. This feeling, this sensation that time is flowing, doesn't require previous moments, previous frames, to be sequentially illuminated. And if you think about it for one more moment, you'll realize that's a very good thing. Because the notion of a projector light sequentially bringing moments to life is highly problematic for another, even more basic reason. If the projector light properly did its job and illuminated a given moment, say the stroke of midnight, New Year's Eve 1999, what would it mean for that moment to then go dark? If the moment were lit, then being illuminated would be a feature of the moment. A feature as everlasting and unchanging as everything else happening at that moment. To experience illumination, to be alive, to be the present, to be the now, and to then experience darkness, to be dormant, to be the past, to be what was, is to experience change. But the concept of change has no meaning with respect to a single moment in time. The change would have to occur through time. The change would mark the passing of time. But what notion of time could that possibly be? By definition, moments don't include the passing of time, at least not the time we're aware of, because moments just are. They are the raw material of time. They don't change. A particular moment can no more change in time than a particular location can move in space. If the location were to move, it would be a different location in space. If a moment in time were to change, it would be a different moment in time. The intuitive image of a projector light that brings each new now to life just doesn't hold up to careful examination. Instead, every moment is illuminated, and every moment remains illuminated. Every moment is. Under close scrutiny, the flowing river of time more closely resembles a giant block of ice, with every moment forever frozen into place. This conception of time is significantly different from the one most of us have internalized. Even though it emerged from his own insights, Einstein was not hardened to the difficulty of fully absorbing such a profound change in perspective. Rudolf Carnap recounts a wonderful conversation he had with Einstein on this subject. Einstein said that the problem of the now worried him seriously. He explained that the experience of the now means something special for man, something essentially different from the past and the future. but that this important difference does not and cannot occur within physics. That this experience cannot be grasped by science seemed to him a matter of painful but inevitable resignation. This resignation leaves open a pivotal question. Is science unable to grasp a fundamental quality of time that the human mind embraces as readily as the lungs take in air? Or does the human mind impose on time a quality of its own making, one that is artificial, and that hence does not show up in the laws of physics? If you were to ask me this question during the working day, I'd side with the latter perspective. But by nightfall, when critical thought eases into the ordinary routines of life, it's hard to maintain full resistance to the former viewpoint. Time is a subtle subject, and we are far from understanding it fully. It is possible that some insightful person will one day devise a new way of looking at time and reveal a bona fide physical foundation for a time that flows. Then again, the discussion above, based on logic and relativity, may turn out to be the full story. Certainly, though, the feeling that time flows is deeply ingrained in our experience and thoroughly pervades our thinking and language. So much so that we have lapsed and will continue to lapse into habitual, colloquial descriptions that refer to a flowing time. But don't confuse language with reality. Human language is far better at capturing human experience than at expressing deep physical laws. Chapter 6. Chance and the Arrow. Does time have a direction? Even if time doesn't flow, it still makes sense to ask whether it has an arrow, whether there is a direction to the way things unfold in time that can be discerned in the laws of physics. It is the question whether there is some intrinsic order in how events are sprinkled along space-time, and whether there is an essential scientific difference between one ordering of events and the reverse ordering. As everyone already knows, there certainly appears to be a huge distinction of this sort. It's what gives life promise and makes experience poignant. Yet, as we'll see, explaining the distinction between past and future is harder than you'd think. Rather remarkably, the answer we'll settle upon is intimately bound up with the precise conditions at the origin of the universe. The puzzle. 1,000 times a day, our experiences reveal a distinction between things unfolding one way in time and the reverse. A piping hot pizza cools down en route from Domino's, but we never find a pizza arriving hotter than when it was removed from the oven. Cream stirred into coffee forms a uniformly tan liquid, but we never see a cup of light coffee unstir and separate into white cream and black coffee. Eggs fall, cracking and splattering, but we never see splattered eggs and eggshells gather together and coalesce into uncracked eggs. The compressed carbon dioxide gas in a bottle of Coke rushes outward when we twist off the cap, but we never find spread-out carbon dioxide gas gathering together and swooshing back into the bottle. Ice cubes put into a glass of room-temperature water melt, but we never see globules in a room-temperature glass of water coalesce into solid cubes of ice. These common sequences of events, as well as countless others, happen in only one temporal order. They never happen in reverse, and so they provide a notion of before and after. They give us a consistent and seemingly universal conception of past and future. These observations convince us that were we to examine all of space-time from the outside, we would see significant asymmetry along the time axis. Splattered eggs the world over would lie to one side, the side we conventionally call the future, of their whole unsplattered counterparts. Perhaps the most pointed example of all is that our minds seem to have access to a collection of events that we call the past, our memories. But none of us seems able to remember the collection of events we call the future. So it seems obvious that there is a big difference between the past and the future. There seems to be a manifest orientation to how an enormous variety of things unfold in time. There seems to be a manifest distinction between the things we can remember, the past, and the things we cannot, the future. This is what we mean by times having an orientation, a direction, or an arrow. Physics, and science more generally, is founded on regularities. Scientists study nature, find patterns, and codify these patterns in natural laws. You would think, therefore, that the enormous wealth of regularity leading us to perceive an apparent arrow of time would be evidence of a fundamental law of nature. A silly way to formulate such a law would be to introduce the law of spilled milk, stating that glasses of milk spill but don't unspill, or the law of splattered eggs, stating that eggs break and splatter, but never unsplatter and unbreak. But that kind of law buys us nothing. It is merely descriptive and offers no explanation beyond a simple observation of what happens. Yet we expect that somewhere in the depths of physics there must be a less silly law describing the motion and properties of the particles that make up pizza, milk, eggs, coffee, people, and stars, the fundamental ingredients of everything, that shows why things evolve through one sequence of steps, but never the reverse. Such a law would give a fundamental explanation to the observed arrow of time. The perplexing thing is that no one has discovered any such law. What's more, the laws of physics that have been articulated from Newton through Maxwell and Einstein, and up until today, show a complete symmetry between past and future. Nowhere in any of these laws do we find a stipulation that they apply one way in time but not in the other. Nowhere is there any distinction between how the laws look or behave when applied in either direction in time. The laws treat what we call past and future on a completely equal footing. Even though experience reveals over and over again that there is an arrow of how events unfold in time, this arrow seems not to be found in the fundamental laws of physics. Past, future, and the fundamental laws of physics. How can this be? Do the laws of physics provide no underpinning that distinguishes past from future? How can there be no law of physics explaining that events unfold in this order, but never in reverse? The situation is even more puzzling. The known laws of physics actually declare, contrary to our lifetime of experiences, that light coffee can separate into black coffee and white cream. A splattered yolk and a collection of smashed shell pieces can gather themselves together and form a perfectly smooth, unbroken egg. The melted ice in a glass of room-temperature water can fuse back together into cubes of ice. The gas released when you open your soda can rush back into the bottle. All the physical laws that we hold dear fully support what is known as time reversal symmetry. This is the statement that if some sequence of events can unfold in one temporal order, cream and coffee mix, eggs break, gas rushes outward, then these events can also unfold in reverse. Cream and coffee unmix, eggs unbreak, gas rushes inward. I'll elaborate on this shortly, but the one-sentence summary is that not only do known laws fail to tell us why we see events unfold in only one order, they also tell us that, in theory, events can unfold in reverse order. Note that time reversal symmetry is not about time itself being reversed or running backward. Instead, as we've described, time reversal symmetry is concerned with whether events that happen in time, in one particular temporal order, can also happen in the reverse order. A more appropriate phrase might be event reversal, or process reversal, or event order reversal, but we'll stick with the conventional term. The burning question is, why don't we ever see such things? I think it's a safe bet that no one has ever actually witnessed a splattered egg unsplattering. But if the laws of physics allow it, and if, moreover, those laws treat splattering and unsplattering equally, why does one never happen while the other does? Time reversal symmetry. As a first step toward resolving this puzzle, we need to understand in more concrete terms what it means for the known laws of physics to be time reversal symmetric. To this end, imagine it's the 25th century, and you're playing tennis in the new interplanetary league with your partner, Cool Stroke Williams. Somewhat unused to the reduced gravity on Venus, Cool Stroke hits a gargantuan backhand that launches the ball into the deep, isolated darkness of space. A passing space shuttle films the ball as it goes by and sends the footage to CNN, Celestial News Network, for broadcast. Here's the question. If the technicians at CNN were to make a mistake and run the film of the tennis ball in reverse, would there be any way to tell? Well, if you knew the heading and orientation of the camera during the filming, you might be able to recognize their error. But could you figure it out solely by looking at the footage itself, with no additional information? The answer is no. If, in the correct, forward, time direction, the footage showed the ball floating by from left to right, then in reverse it would show the ball floating by from right to left. And certainly the laws of classical physics allow tennis balls to move either left or right. So the motion you see when the film is run in either the forward time direction or the reverse time direction is perfectly consistent with the laws of physics. We've so far imagined that no forces were acting on the tennis ball, so that it moved with constant velocity. Let's now consider the more general situation by including forces. According to Newton, the effect of a force is to change the velocity of an object. Forces impart accelerations. Imagine, then, that after floating a while through space, the ball is captured by Jupiter's gravitational pull, causing it to move with increasing speed in a downward, rightward sweeping arc toward Jupiter's surface. If you play a film of this motion in reverse, the tennis ball will appear to move in an arc that sweeps upward and toward the left, away from Jupiter. Here's the new question. Is the motion depicted by the film when played backward, the time-reversed motion of what was actually filmed, allowed by the classical laws of physics? Is it motion that could